You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 349, our 42nd Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on? Other than you losing in fantasy.
I know. It's pretty hopeless, to be honest with you. You know, I had such a good draft. I had I don't even want to think about who I don't have now. I had three solid running backs in the draft. You know, one was Le'Veon Bell. He got hurt early, so I cut him. And then the other two are now in injured reserve. So I'm like literally looking for people with pulses. You know, yeah. I don't know if I win another game the rest of the year. It's just bad.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I really don't feel bad for you. So, you know, I don't know what
to
say.
No, you don't.
Yeah. I don't know what to say to that.
Those are the breaks. Are the breaks, you know.
I hear you. Well,
if I'm undermanned, I'm easy pickings. So,
yeah. I can't help but smile. I don't know why. You know, it is what it is. But hey, Mike, our poll, you know, last week closed. And I just wanted to, again, thank everybody that voted in our next book study. And Mike, you'll find it interesting that we had somebody from all 50 states vote in America. So that's pretty cool. And then we had people vote in 77 different countries around the world.
Wow. That's crazy, actually.
That is crazy. We appreciate South Dakota was holding on there for the longest time. So finally, a couple people voted from South Dakota. So if you're in South Dakota and you voted in the poll,
you know who you are.
Yeah, thank you. You were the last state to hold out, but we finally got it. But 77 different countries. That's pretty impressive. So thank you.
Yeah, it is.
Everybody.
Thanks to everybody who did vote.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of countries in Africa, you know, there's quite a few of them in there.
You know what we should have done, Trey? We could do this, I guess, in 2 years or maybe 4 years. But little stickers that are the Naked Bible logo that says, I voted.
There you go.
You know, that would have been perfect, you know, for this week.
It would have been.
This is why I'm not in marketing. I think of great ideas after they're too late. So.
Yeah, well, and the logistics of me or you having to ship 77 stickers around the world probably, you know, doesn't.
Well, just in the even in the U.S., you know, because it's the election.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Our I voted little sticker would look different than everybody else's, but so it might generate a question. I'll confess, it's a dumb idea, but it sounded good. But the more you talk about it, the dumber it sounds.
It sounds good in theory, you know, but then we'd have to collect addresses, and then we'd have to I don't deal with stamps, Mike. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't write checks. I don't deal with the mail. If you're not online, I'm not paying you. So don't send me a bill. If you're utilities or you're anything, I am not going to pay you if you don't have an online option because I don't write checks. I don't have stamps and I'm never going back.
Well, you don't even do stamps.com and they're not supporting the podcast. No. Maybe they should after this episode.
No, I'm not doing stamps ever again. The days of having, I'm barely old enough to remember having to write out a check. Like if you go to the grocery store and everybody's sitting there waiting, you know, to get checked out and you have to fill out your checks, you know, it's amazing how.
Those are the lines. I still pick those lines. You know, I manage to pick those lines when people are like taking out a loan, you know,
now you can
they're
scan
filling
your,
out a loan application for the at your grocery store.
No. Now you can just scan it. Better yet, you can just get it delivered to your house. I'm all about online stuff.
You don't. So you don't want to watch the lady in front of you pull out a wad of coupons like there's 300 coupons.
I will literally just abandon my basket and leave all my stuff there and walk out the store. I am not
abandon ship.
But I appreciate the concept of the coupons. Like those people who do the coupon thing and they buy in bulk and stuff, and you know they make some great savings. Man. You know, but then you got a basement full of. 5 Tides, 17,000 soaps, you know, 47 toilet paper, which is good, but you know, I'm just
see then they can go digital and sell that stuff on eBay.
That's true.
Especially when there's another panic.
And if, Yeah, and then if they home deliver it, I'll be your first customer. But
yeah, there you go.
All right. Well, Mike, we've got some good questions here, and I bet the people would rather hear you answer questions than talk about fantasy and grocery shopping with checks.
I don't know. It's good stuff.
Maybe we can just do an entire episode one of these days of nothing of that kind of talk. Nothing.
Just follow fantasy. Mike to the grocery store.
Yeah.
Those I'm the line that with the coupon lady, and then the receipt thing, the paper runs out, you know. Mm. And of course there's something that doesn't have a barcode. I'm all that. Mm. That's what I do.
There you go. Well, not me. But all right. Well, how about we just get to the questions, Mike? We stink at the other stuff. Sounds so good. let's just get to the Bible stuff where we're good at. All right. This one's from Philip, and Philip has a question about one word, law. In John 10:34, Jesus says, "Is it not written in your law, 'I have said you are gods'?" Why does Jesus refer to the book of Psalms under the category of law? I looked at the word, and it can mean custom, or the Pentateuch, or the Old Testament in general. None of them really fit a book like Psalms. Is there something deeper going on, or am I just being too curious?
Well, you sort of answered the question already. If it can refer to the general Old Testament, the Psalms are in the Old Testament, so there you go. But, you know, to drill down a little bit more, that phrasing happens elsewhere. You get it in John 12:34, John 15:25. You get it in Paul, 1 Corinthians 14:21. And when this term is used, you know, that could be translated law, obviously. The usage in these cases, though, refers to the Old Testament in general, as, you know, Philip pointed out in his question. And, it, you know, it's sort of the idea of referring to any part of the Old Testament as the rule or authority for doctrine and life. You know, this was their sacred scriptures. The Hebrew Bible is inspired. So they could and did use this word in that sense. This is our general rule for, you know, faith and practice, so to speak. The same thing is found in rabbinic writings. So contemporaneous sources or sources a little bit later, you'll find this. C.K. Barrett, or I think it was Barrett's commentary, he makes a note about the Corinthians passage where he cites the fact that rabbinic literature will use Torah sometimes to cover, you know, the whole Old Testament. I looked this up in TDNT, the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, because I wanted to see what they said about the, you know, the term. You usually get really long, you know, articles and that thing. So I'll just quote a little portion from TDNT. It says that it makes the note that Paul likes to associate a verse or an idea from the Torah together with, like he combines that with a passage from the prophets, and which is an approach found in rabbinic material. In TDNT actually has a grocery list of rabbinic passages where this is done. But the idea is that Paul or the New Testament writer is going along and he essentially combines an idea from Torah, but while he's citing something else because the prophet or whatever passage, you know, is in question in these instances, is also drawing something from or expressing an idea that is found in the Torah anyway. So, you know, in this case, in Psalm 82, it's a pretty clear reference. You're not going to find, you know, ye are gods in the Torah. Okay? So it's a little bit different. But the practice of generally using the term law to refer to other parts of the Old Testament, because all of the Old Testament was instruction, which is what Torah means, okay? Instruction and binding. It had authority for doctrine and practice. TDNT also makes the comment that he refers to Simon ben Azai, a rabbi, quote, and this is what's said about him in the rabbinic writings, "He sat and expounded and correlated the sayings of the Torah to the sayings of the prophets and the sayings of the prophets to those of the writings." And that's where you'd find the Psalms. "A fire flamed around about him, and the sayings of the Torah rejoiced as on the day when they were given at Sinai." So, you know, it's kind of like if you've ever read rabbinical writing, that's kind of what it always sounds like. You know, this fantastical, you know, glorious thing that whatever rabbi is doing at any time, you know, they'll dress it up with language like that. You know, fire flamed about him. You know, pardon my skepticism there, but you know, anyway, they want to sort of not only glorify their teachers, you know, in their history, in the rabbinic writings, but in this case, they actually make a helpful observation that this was a common thing, common way to think. So it leaks out of the New Testament. So there's nothing odd, you know, about it. I mean, to our ear, it's odd because we're used to, you know, thinking law, prophets, writings, and we don't have sort of a history in terms of the way our authorities, i.e., in their case, the rabbis, would cite the Old Testament using the same terminology.
Keith has our next question. I always assumed that the Lord's Prayer on earth as it is in heaven meant that the Lord's will was done in heaven, but that human rebellion on earth meant that it was not achieved on earth, at least not at this time. Yet the sin of the watchers, war in heaven, and other language bucks against this understanding. What is the proper understanding?
Yeah, I think we have a little bit of a conflation here. You know, when I hear sin of the watchers, I think of Genesis 6, and there's no war in heaven described with respect to the Genesis 6 event. I mean, there is a transgression, but my point is you don't get the war in heaven language there. But setting that aside, you know, the Lord's Prayer expresses the desire that God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So it's pretty clear in that respect. The idea is that God, you know, the prayer expresses the desire that God be king on the earth as he is in heaven. It's a prayer that expresses a wish, you know, looking forward to that day. And, you know, obviously rebellion is what has led to the disconnect and impedes that vision, you know, from being accomplished, at least at the present time. But rebellion doesn't and won't prevent it. Okay, you know, hence the prayer, just expressing the desire. There's no sense in the passage that it's not going to happen. It just expresses the desire of the heart that it will happen, like, you know, soon. It's a wish, you know, it's a prayer, it's a desire. So I think the meaning of it generally is pretty clear, but I don't see anything really having to do with the watchers in, you know, the language here or in the circumstances that the rule of God is being impeded. I don't see anything specific. In other words, that goes back to that episode.
Derek has our next question. What is the reason that Deuteronomy 27:5 has the Israelites being instructed to build an altar without using an iron tool? I see where Exodus 20:25 states that altars will not be made of hewn stone because stones are made profane or polluted when hewn. Commentaries mostly skip over the reasoning, though some suggest it might lead to accidental idolatry. The Watchers passing technology to man came to my mind and wondered what Dr. Heiser's thoughts were on the prohibition.
Yeah, generally, I don't think this derives from the Sin of the Watchers, that episode, as metals could be and were used legitimately by Israelites in other contexts, you know, lots of other contexts. You know, it's an interesting verse, though. You know, the altar, Deuteronomy 27:5 has this instruction where the altar is to be built from stones unhewn, you know, just stones in their natural state. They are uncrafted, you know, unhewn. They're not touched in any way or fashioned in any way. And this actually follows the rule earlier in Exodus. Exodus 20:25 has the same thought. Let me just read Exodus 20:25, the earlier reference here, just so people can be aware of that other one. If you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stones. For if you wield your tool on it, you profane it. And that's, it actually gives a reason there. But the question is, well, how? Okay. So I looked this up in a couple commentaries just, you know, to see what they would say. And they all basically say the same thing. Like, T. Gay is pretty blunt. The reason for the prohibition is uncertain. That's essentially what they say. Like, we don't know. But I have an article on this, and I'm going to read a little bit from this article. It's Saul Olyan, who's, you know, he's known for lots of things in Old Testament study. you know, lots of ritual stuff and even, you know, angelic stuff, at least in rabbinic material. But Olyan actually produced an article on this. It's called Why an Altar of Unfinished Stones. Subtitle is Some Thoughts on Exodus 20, 25 and Deuteronomy 27, 5 and 6. And this is, you know, from a scholarly journal. ZAW is the abbreviation. It's a German journal, but this article is in English, so 1996. And he writes this. I'll just a few excerpts that I think are kind of interesting. He says, scholars have long noted the ban in the Book of the Covenant, Exodus 20, 25, and the Deuteronomistic materials, Deuteronomy 27, 5, and 6, on the use of finished stones, ashlar is the term, for building Yahweh's altar of burnt offerings. But a satisfactory explanation for the interdiction has yet to be presented. Most treatments either avoid the issue entirely, and yes, that's true, or offer one or two possible suggestions, often without much conviction. That's also true. Some scholars have suggested that the proscription on finished stones represented an attempt to keep Canaanite or other supposedly quote-unquote alien elements out of the Israelite cult. And others have argued that cutting stones causes them to lose a presumed quote-unquote numinous quality, unquote. Still others have proposed that finished stones were prohibited on account of their luxury. Wow, okay. They're more expensive. It also has been suggested, Olyan says, that the ban has associations with semi-nomadic form of life. Finally, there are those who do not take any firm position. None of these theses, so common in the literature, none of them adequately addresses the problem. Not one has been convincingly argued. And so what he's going to do is he's going to try to unravel this. So he says here, perhaps the most engaging explanation thus far is that of Roland DeVoe, who asserted regarding Exodus 20:25 that the text says, and then there's DeVoe wrote in French, so this is my internet, you know, translation here of DeVoe's quote. The idea that iron profane stone, which is explained by the general concern to use it for the service of God, only you should only use things in the service of God in their natural state before they're used by humans. Okay, so that's essentially what DeVoe is saying. Now Olyan says that DeVoe identifies the preservation of the natural state, okay, of something used in the cult as the underlying general concern behind this prescription. And I think he's onto something here because of the comment in Exodus 20:25 about if you use hewn stones, then you profane them. Okay, so there's something about natural state versus something worked on that profanes them. And you know, Olyan goes on to say DeVoe, you know, would argue that human agency was the source of defilement. And DeVoe cites Numbers 19:2, Deuteronomy 21:3 and 4, and 1 Samuel 6:7 in support of the assertion. Each of those passages concerns an ox fit for sacrifice or ritual slaughter because it has never had a yoke put on it. So it hasn't served any human use. Like the stones of the altar, the ox has never been defiled by human agency. It exists in its natural state. So Olyan says, well, I think he's onto something. It's interesting, but he takes a slightly different tack. I'm just going to read his conclusion because I think it's interesting. He says, DeVoe's paradigm does not explain all of the relevant data cogently, neither the loss of the natural state nor human agency as the source of defilement effectively elucidate all of the evidence pertaining to defilement and its avoidance in the cult. Not all sacrificial animals in their natural states are acceptable to Yahweh, so that there's that. Not all defilement to be kept out of the cultic sphere is the result of human agency, so there's that inconsistency. I suggest, Olyan says, that the proscription is more convincingly explained as one expression of a concern broadly attested in various biblical sources, and that is, to separate the deity and his space, conceived as holy, from forms of physical alteration understood to produce defilement of that space. The paradigmatic notion of wholeness and completeness, in other words, a dearth, an absence of defiling alterations, as characteristic of holiness developed by, and he quotes Mary Douglas here, who's a very famous scholar on Levitical thought, This idea developed by Douglas with regard to the bodies of sacrificial animals and priests may be applied more broadly to include the stones of the altar and the temple and anchored firmly in philological, exegetical analysis of the range of the terms used in the passage. So in more standard English, what he's saying is, you know, DeVoe's on to something here, but we need to think of it more broadly that if you – how can I summarize this? He's saying this is one means by which a deity's sacred space and common space are distinguished. If it's common space used by humans, well, then humans have done things to it to make it their living space. Whereas, you know, sacred space, you don't do that. You use things that you don't have to change. It's kind of like a creation order argument. So basically tying this in with priests and animals in Douglas's work, she is one who would argue that the reason why certain things are prohibited is because they lack something. There's some imperfection in it. So the idea would be that if you take a stone and you chip away at it, the stone is losing something. It's now not in pristine form. So think of the concept of something being in pristine form. And so that idea of keeping it complete and whole is the thought behind these prohibitions. So, I don't know if that's completely correct. It makes sense within the wider system of the way, you know, Leviticus presents a distinction between sacred and profane, you know, something whole, something that has lost something. Those are broad principles that work throughout the Levitical, you know, system. So what Olyan is saying is we should apply the same idea here, and you know it makes sense. But again, I haven't looked at it enough. I mean, I've you know, other than this question, I've never really examined it. But you know, if Douglas, her work isn't perfect, okay, she doesn't answer every quandary in Leviticus. But I will say this for her, and other scholars have said it too, she answers most of them. So I think it is a general good idea to apply her perspective here, the findings to get some consistency in these ritual regulations. I think it's a good strategy, and at least in my head right now, that makes sense.
Charles brings forth our next question. The throne room scene in Psalm 45 mentions a queen. Roman Catholics say the queen adorned in gold from Ophir in Psalms 45 is Mary. And Protestants tend to say the queen in Psalms 45 is the church. I feel there is maybe some better explanation, but I haven't been able to think of one. This is a throne room scene. Is there any divine council theology that has a better answer?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything specific divine council-wise in here. So that's the easy part. The normative word for queen in the Hebrew Bible, Malkah, it's used 35 times, is not in this passage. In 45:9, we have Shegal. It's used twice in the Hebrew Bible. The other time is in Nehemiah 2:6. So the question is there any significance to this term as opposed to using the normal term for queen? Well, you know, Halot, and again, that's a Hebrew lexicon, has the term being drawn from Akkadian, Shah Akali. Shegel, Shah Akali. Later Hebrew uses the plural of Shegel to denote women who sleep around. So some scholars actually speculate the term denotes the king's consort, or maybe a wife to be, but somebody who's not actually the queen. Maybe it's a woman he's already slept with. Now you could use sort of Esther here as an example. You know, Esther, if you read Esther 1, you know, closely, she moves from the place where the virgins are kept, and then she has her night with the king, and then she's put in a different place where the concubines are. Okay. This is just the way things were done in the ancient Near East. You know, this is how kings approached, you know, women. So, you know, if we want to think, well, you know, this is David in Psalm 45, David wouldn't do that. Well, let's try to remember Bathsheba. Let's try to remember David's non-refusal of taking Saul's wives. And of course, David's taking multiple wives of his own choice. All that is to say, if you want this to be Mary or the church, this is going to get pretty messy. It's a good example of trying to force an Old Testament passage to do both Catholic and Protestant theology. Okay, let's try to not do that. Because it's very easy to pull one point out of a passage and say, oh, look, that's Mary. Oh, no, it isn't. It's the church. The church is the bride. Well, if you actually sort of put it back into its own world, things can get pretty messy pretty quickly. So let's try not to do that. Now, I would recommend, you know, my go-to resource on Psalms has become Golden Gaze, three volumes. But they're technical, but they're just quite good. So I'm going to refer to him here. Golden Gay notes that to this point in Psalm 45, if you're reading through the Psalm, the marriage has not yet occurred. So it may refer, you know, that this woman here in the picture may refer to the potential bride who is not yet the queen, in which case we wouldn't have a queen. Okay, obviously, if they're not married yet. The king has to marry you to be the queen. Okay, they're not married yet, so we don't have a queen. Now, Golden Gay translates the term Shegel as great princess, and the context makes, you know, sense in that regard. Here's what he writes. He says, so far there's been no mention of a wedding. There's no need to interpret verses 8 and 9 as relating distinctly to a wedding scene. The great princess, and he has slash queen, okay, because there is, in his mind, there is a queen in the picture. Just bear with me here. The great princess slash queen is probably not the bride, but the queen mother, who will now address the bride in verses 10 through 13. So if you're listening, what you need to do is look at Psalm 45, and the presumed reference to the queen, even though we don't have the normal word for queen, is in verse 9. And what Golden Gay is saying, well, that's not actually the queen. That's a different woman. It's the woman who's going to be the bride. And then this woman gets addressed in verses 10 through 13 by somebody else. And Golden Gay thinks it's the queen mother because of what's said in verses 10 through 13. Now, if you read it that way, I'll admit it does make sense, even though we don't have anything explicitly in that regard. You know, Golden Gay, again, this is a technical commentary. He wants to translate daughters of kings earlier in, I think it's verse 8, it's either verse 8 or verse 9, as singular, you know, one daughter, due to parallelism with Shegel in the next line. Now, it is grammatically possible to do that, but it's beyond the scope of this podcast to get into ancient Semitic morphology, okay, and why Golden Gay could have a point there. But my point for this episode is that what this all means is that it's far from certain that we have a queen, a king's wife, because if it's the queen mother, it'd be his mom, all right? It's far from certain that we have a queen in the Shegel of Psalm 45:9. So it's pretty unwise to build theology on it, on a thing that you don't know is even there. Now, personally, I don't think it's pretty obvious. I'm not with the Catholics here, because Psalm 45 is not about Mary. It's not about Catholicism. We don't even know if we have a queen there, for one thing. But also, you know, I don't think either Catholic or Protestant approaches really honor the context of the psalm. The context is the Israelite king. It doesn't have the church or Mary or even Jesus specifically in view in its own context. When it gets quoted in the New Testament by Jesus to befuddle the Pharisees and then point to his status as the Davidic king, there's no comment on the queen. If we want the analogy, okay, if we want to, you know, try to go with this analogy, then let's press the other points. Okay, if we have a queen here, well, then who are the ladies in waiting? Are they believers? Are the believers only women? Or are only women believers? Who are the people of Tyre in the passage? You know, then we can always loop back to the messiness of kings and the women they want to marry, or who are just consorts, or, you know, what's their status in the harem? Again, it is very unwise to make this passage do Mary theology or do church theology. So hopefully that's sufficient, again, for the sake of this episode.
Christopher has a question about the King James Version reading of John 3:13, where it has, Son of Man who is in heaven. One, is it possible this is the correct reading? And two, if so, is this a reference to the Son of Man of Daniel 7?
Well, I think it certainly could be a reference to the Son of Man in Daniel 7, regardless of how do I want to say this. You could have the Son of Man in Daniel 7 referenced regardless of whether you accept the phrase Son of Man who is in heaven or just take the shorter version of that. Now that's going to sound pretty odd, but I'll try and explain. Let me just read what Metzger says on this verse in his textual commentary, because he was one of the editors of the United Bible Society Greek New Testament. He says, on the one hand, a minority of the committee preferred the reading, in the Greek, it's just anthropou haon ento uranu, you know, which basically means you have the word man, anthropou, the one who is in heaven, the Son of Man in heaven, right? So a minority of the committee preferred that reading, arguing that, number one, if the short reading, again, just Son of Man, supported almost exclusively by Egyptian witnesses, were original, there is no discernible motive that would have prompted copyists to add the words, the one who is in heaven, resulting in a most difficult saying. And he adds here in parentheses, the statement in 1:18 not being parallel, that's John 1:18, would scarcely have prompted the addition. Secondly, Metzger says, the diversity of readings implies, you know, the fact that you have different readings, implies that the expression, the Son of Man, the one who is in heaven, having been found objectionable or superfluous in the context, was modified either by omitting the participial clause, blah, 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 blah. What you have here in English is that, look, if you go to John 3:13, I'm just going to go there. We'll see what ESV has, see what ESV does with this. Here it says, no one has ascended into heaven except the one who descended from heaven, the Son of Man. Then it has a footnote. After the Son of Man, some manuscripts add who is in heaven, the one who is in heaven. So does the original text just say Son of Man, or does it say the Son of Man who is in heaven? So you have to make a choice. And so what Metzger's saying is, you know, to add it makes it kind of difficult. So why would anyone have added? Usually what scribes tend to do is they tend to take a difficult, you know, passage and try to simplify it, you know, for readers. Okay, well, sure. You know, and the other side would say, well, the more difficult reading is often therefore the correct one. So this is how the two sides go back and forth. You know, the honest answer is it could be either. Nobody really knows for sure, because they're just trying to sort of do logical rules. You know, what would a scribe do or not do? You know, when it comes to deciding, is the short version correct or is this edition correct? I would say this. The phrase is indeed difficult to say the Son of Man who is in heaven. Let me go back and read John 3:13 just to have it ring in your head again. And I'm going to add the addition here. No one has ascended into heaven except he who descended from heaven, the Son of Man who is in heaven. Think about that. Do it again. No one has ascended into heaven except he who descended from heaven, the Son of Man who is in heaven. Well, it doesn't make much sense. The addition, the longer version, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Why? Because the Son of Man Jesus is talking about is himself, and he's on earth, not in heaven. So why would he be talking still about a Son of Man who is in heaven? If it's him, he's not in heaven anymore. He's on earth. You know, either way, since you have the phrase Son of Man, I think that you can loop Daniel 7 into this, because Jesus is applying this to himself. And you'll see this in other passages. Again, I don't think every reference to Son of Man, you know, is pointing to Daniel 7, you know, really far from it. But I think there are occasionally, you know, passages where the phrase is used that it does. So to add this phrase, or to argue that it's original, I mean, some people would say, well, it's definitely original because it's kind of weird. It's difficult. You know, the one of the cardinal rules among textual critics is that the more difficult reading is the one to be preferred, because scribes would tend to simplify. Okay, well, that's a rule that you just made up. I mean, it's a reasonable rule, but it doesn't make us omniscient. Like, it's not the law of the Medes and the Persians. I mean, ultimately, we don't really know. But again, what I will say is that it really is kind of odd to be there. So my thinking is, you know, I would lean toward the side that it was added. Again, even though that violates sort of the cardinal ideas of textual criticism, you just made it more difficult. Well, you know, maybe somebody's trying to more explicitly link the phrase to Daniel 7. They felt some urge to do that. Who knows? I don't know. But to me, the whole thing just doesn't make much sense, because if it's applied to Jesus, and I think it is there in context, then Son of Man's not in heaven anyway. Now, I would say no matter which one you pick, the idea of Jesus' pre-existence is certainly not harmed, because the pre-existence of Jesus is taught in a number of passages, not just this one. So I don't think we need to worry about that, you know, theologically. That idea theologically does not derive from John 3:13. So, you know, the short answer is, yeah, you know, it's possible. But again, I think it's kind of clunky to have it there just because the Son of Man, Jesus, is on earth. He ain't in heaven anymore when this line is uttered.
Gloria in Toledo, Ohio, has a question, and it is, how does one pray in light of the Deuteronomy worldview? How does one pray for the unsaved in light of free will? Regarding binding and releasing, Matthew 18 does not talk about prayer, and yet I hear this frequently. Can you bind spirits for other people?
Yeah, I'm going to presume Gloria means Deuteronomy 32 worldview here. And so it's hard for me to see a problem in the first two of these. How would you pray in light of the Deuteronomy 32 worldview? Well, you would pray for the fulfillment of the Great Commission. Because the Deuteronomy 32 worldview is about the diminishment, of the kingdom of the principalities and powers, you know, the Gentiles being looped back into the family of God. It's linked to the Great Commission because of Paul's reference to the fullness of the Gentiles being brought in, which is a precursor to the second coming and the day of the Lord in the end. Okay, so how do you pray in light of that? You pray for the fulfillment of the Great Commission. How does one pray for, you know, someone who's, you know, not a believer in light of free will? Well, they do have a free will, so you would pray that they believe. You pray that they would use that free will to accept the gospel. So I don't really see what, I mean, I could be missing something in the question, but as it pops into my head here, I don't really see much of the either problem here. I'm not sure what's troubling with respect to both of those. Now, the third one regarding the binding and the loosing, you know, in the episode that we did on this topic, I spent a good bit of time going over why the language of binding and loosing refers to exorcism. You know, when demons are exorcised, they are, of course, in other people. They're not in the exorcist. So if the question is, you know, when she asks, can you bind spirits for other people? If the reference is to what the passage actually means, what the phrase actually means, can you exorcise demons from other people? Well, the answer would obviously be yes. You know, this is what happens in the New Testament. And that, of course, isn't unique, even in the modern world. So if that's what it means, again, that's pretty easy. But what I sense here is that this binding and loosing idea is often associated with, not with exorcism, but with other things. You know, sort of maybe the question is coming from the world of deliverance ministries, which is ironic. I did an interview yesterday where the two guys interviewing me had come out of a deliverance ministry, and this is exactly what they wanted to talk about. That, again, to sort of loosely quote them, they came from a tradition that basically all of your problems, your sins, the things going bad in your life, that there's a demon behind every one of them. So there's a demon of lust. There's a demon of, you know, depression. There's a demon of, you know, just behind the coronavirus or not having a job or, you know, all these things that sort of people can be afflicted by, the things that cause them concern in life. You know, there was in their tradition, there was sort of a demonic reason for all of it. And I asked them, is there a demon of incompetence? And I didn't mean that as a joke. I was serious about it, because my follow-up question is, do we ever get to make a mistake and be accountable for it? And I use that as a segue to getting into my own feeling is that when we blame our sins and our failure to trust God on demons, we dismiss our own responsibility and we turn ourselves into victims. And that is not the New Testament portrayal of either sin or the struggle of the Christian life. You don't have passages that link specific demons to specific sins. You just don't. In the New Testament, you have quite the opposite. And I'm going to, let's see here. The easy path here would be to quote a little bit from my demons book, but I'm going to just try to summarize this. I mean, for instance, there are New Testament warnings about, you know, giving opportunity to the devil, Ephesians 4:27. Practicing sin over and over again. Practicing sin is of the devil, 1 John 3:8. I mean, there are these kinds of verses, but there are lots of verses that link the struggles, you know, with sin and otherwise to ourselves. There's a whole New Testament theology about the flesh versus the spirit for believers. For Paul, for James, James chapter 1. I mean, just look at James, you know, chapter 1 that I might as well just go and read it so that people can have this in their heads. In James chapter 1, he writes this. Let's see here. There it is. James chapter 1, verse 12. Let's start there. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. I mean, the passage doesn't say each person is tempted when he's lured away by the demon of fill in the blank. I mean, you don't have this in New Testament theology. In Romans 7, you have Paul struggling with his own flesh. Peter writes about his own struggle with the struggle between fleshly lusts, which war against the soul. And the reason is, in New Testament theology, we are redeemed people who are trapped in unredeemed bodies. Okay, we are subject, you know, to the temptations and weaknesses of life, you know, of our flesh. That's where New Testament theology comes in. So I have a real problem, you know, with ministries that want to link behaviors and failures that we should just, you know, own up to and take responsibility for. They want to link that to a demon, because that makes you a victim. It makes you not responsible. You're just a helpless victim. No, you're not. You're not a helpless victim. I mean, there are plenty of instructions in the New Testament about not doing that thing that you say that you can't help doing because there's some demon making you do it or victimizing you. You know, is there a demon for a failure to be a good disciple? You know, I asked you, is there a demon for incompetence? Is there a demon of incompetence? Is there a demon of I'm not a good disciple? You know, these are serious questions that I don't see getting asked in certain Christian contexts that I think need to be asked. And so I bring all this up because I don't know that this is behind the question, but I suspect that it is, because if it's just, you know, if binding and loosing refers to exorcism, which I believe it does, again, we spent a whole episode on that. I think that's abundantly demonstrable. Then, yeah, that is a problem that we can address that you know, to help other people. But so I don't think that this refers to specific demonic forces behind things that we're doing and shouldn't be doing or struggles we have. Now, that is not to say that there's no input from the spiritual world, because you do have these passages about, again, giving place to the devil and being tempted, you know, by the devil to do this or that. I mean, there's a role to play there, because we're conscious beings. We have, you know, the spirit world, you know, as conscious beings. I mean, there's some relationship there. But to sort of use that relationship to cancel out what are really dozens of passages in the New Testament about personal discipleship and personal responsibility, to me, is really theologically aberrant and frankly unwarranted and really, really unwise.
All right, Mike, another episode of good questions and good answers. We appreciate everybody that sent in their questions. Again, you can send me your questions at treystrickland@gmail.com. And Mike, next week, we're going back to another single topic.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about a specific word, a single word that, you know, a lot of Christians know this and throw it around, but the word chesed, you know, typically translated as something like loving kindness or steadfast love in the Old Testament. And I want to take a look at that, because there's a loyalty element in here that I think could contribute to the whole concept of believing loyalty. So I want to take a look at that word.
All right, looking forward to it. Again, we appreciate everybody that sent in their questions. We appreciate you, Mike, answering our questions. And with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.